The dark days are done, and the bright days are here. My sunny one shines so sincere. Sunny one so true.
Our next guest is one of those rare talents who has something to say and can say it funny. He's a writer-performer on the new Laugh-In and one of the most popular, outspoken, and entertaining personalities on the local news here in Los Angeles. He's won a half a dozen Emmys as a film critic and host of his own shows. Let's welcome Mr. John Barber, right over there.
Thank you. That was Frank Sinatra, and this is the voice of John Barber. Welcome to John Barber's World. Here in Las Vegas, Nevada, sadly, my Los Angeles Kings are out of the hockey playoffs, the best spectator sport in the world. So like the Kings, I'm spending a lot of time playing golf. And over the weekend, I played golf. One of the fellas I play with, he's a detective with the Las Vegas Police Department. You've seen him a number of times on that reality show called Cops. He patrols the Las Vegas Strip. And he told me last week, he came across again this addled drug addict who was lying on the sidewalk. And he sort of nudged him with his foot and he said, "What are you doing here?" And he said, the guy looked up and said, "My Elvis impression." Anyway, I must tell you, there are two things in life that can absolutely screw up the facts you experience or the facts that you observe, and they are parents and governments. And you can see by the tsunami of media political coverage that we're going to be under for the next couple of years that America's political highway is going to be filled with nothing but potholes and dead ends. This past week, Senator John McCain announced he's running for a sixth term. Not only should somebody run against him, please, somebody run over him. And then there was this other religious fanatic from Idaho, a Republican again, unfortunately, in Indiana, actually, and he wanted the Disney film Black Hole removed from the library because he suggested it was homosexual. And George Bush, our Gomer pile of presidents, said again this week, repeated to an English newspaper man, that God told him to invade Iraq. George Bush is so dumb, he doesn't realize that Satan is a ventriloquist. You know, the American barrel of presidential candidates has no top or no middle. It just has a very large bottom that sadly never seems to run out of pathetic scrapings. Our once libertarian hero, Dr. Ron Paul, announced in Libertarian newspaper today, actually 4 days ago, that he was not endorsing his son Rand for the presidency, but Canadian-born Ted Cruz. Now, Dr. Paul, that's a little like prescribing the guillotine rather than an aspirin for a headache, or voting for Bruce Jenner as man or woman of the year. You know, it's just beyond me where America is going. In at least Americans still have a sense of humor about this. Over the weekend, somebody took a picture, put it up on Facebook, while Hillary Clinton was campaigning in Iowa, and said it showed a lot of stops along the highways where Hillary would be speaking. And the sign said, "Jerky here." You know, politics is absolutely best when it's democratic. But art is at its best when it's dictatorial, because nobody, no committee, as they say, wrote Huckleberry Finn, probably America's greatest book, America's real book, probably the second best book in America since Thomas Paine's Common Sense. And on the way home, I bought Time Magazine's special issue all about Mark Twain. Sometimes they really do a nice job with these books, and it's really well written by Roy Blount Jr. Costs about $16, and every dollar was worth this one line of Mark Twain's. Evidently, multimillionaire steel magnate was lecturing Mark on America and American values and said to him, "America is a Christian nation." And Mark Lane replied simply, "So is hell." That is worth the $16. It is so consummately brilliant. You know, over the years, I've been witness to loads and loads of talent, a lot of really great talent, and some of it that never made it. So I can tell you from close experience, an excellent performance in any endeavor is a talent trait, but winning is a personality trait. And my guest tonight has both in spades. She's a winner in the toughest, if not the oldest, profession, and that is writing. Her perennial and repeated appearances on the bestseller lists with books about Oprah, Jackie O, Nancy Reagan, Rock Hudson, the royal family, Liz Taylor, prove she is the Stephen King of biographers. I wanted to talk to her since I first read her intensely interesting unauthorized bio on Frank Sinatra, and then again at the height of the Lying Bushes Iraq War, when I was looking for some clarity. For the first time in years, I tuned into Larry King because she was scheduled to appear and talk about her book about the Bushes called The Family. But King canceled her. And once again, I forever canceled Larry King. Now, this astonishing lady has two different but amazing books that must not only be read, but seen. One is called Capturing Camelot. It's a stunningly beautiful, heartbreaking compilation of Stanley Tetrick's often intimate photographs of the Kennedys of Camelot, with her very compelling words and wisdom. The other book is equally moving. It's called Let Freedom Ring, again with Stanley's iconic pictures of that man and that moment in history and her indelible words. The brilliance of both is intimated from the very dedication of the latter. She says, quote, "This book is dedicated to all the children who need wings. Rosa sat so Martin could walk. Martin walked so Obama could run. Obama ran so our children could fly," unquote. You don't get words put together much better than that. And all the book's proceeds go to the Children's Defense Fund. So I'm thrilled after all these years to finally meet this amazing woman and this amazing writer, author Kitty Kelly. Kitty, welcome so much to the show.
Oh, John, thank you. Thank you. I can't possibly live up to that introduction. But I want to ask you, you worked with Frank Sinatra.
Yes, dear.
When and how and what was it like?
Well, I'm going to tell you, you know what? I was thinking about telling you this story, but this is your show. But I will tell you the story because it's an amazing story for me, from a kid who was on the streets when he was 15 and almost an orphan. I was at the time the film critic for Los Angeles Magazine, where I was for 10 years, and then 5 years at KNBC in Los Angeles, where I won 3 of my 5 Emmys. And I got a call from the producer, a fellow named George Slaughter. They were doing a revival of Laugh-In. They were going to have no host like they did with Rowan and Martin. They were just going to have sort of guests. And he wanted to pay me to lift some of the jokes that I'd written in my reviews. And I said to him, you know, I've got a better idea since it's here on NBC. Would you let me come on the show as your critic at large? I'll write my own material, it'll be about movies or actors or whatever. And he said that would be great. So anyway, Kitty, I ended up along with George and a fellow named Digby Wolf, who was the fellow who actually created the title Laughing. It wasn't Schlatter. It was a drunken Englishman named Digby Wolf, who was a brilliant comedy writer. And then three or four of us wrote the entire scripts. Anyway, Sinatra was going to be one of the guests. Do you mind my telling you this story?
No, I'm loving it.
Well, it gets much, much more interesting. Anyway, Sinatra, when he came onto the set, he came on with two or three people, as he always did. And the very first time I saw him, Kitty, I was 16 years of age. I'd run away from Toronto, hopped a train, ended up at Lake Tahoe, and I was in the Cal Neva Lodge in the casino. Oh. And in walked Frank Sinatra. He always used to walk with his top coat over his shoulders like a Superman cape.
Yes, exactly. He imitated Jimmy Van Heusen doing that.
Well, there you go. Well, behind him were three large Italians, and arm in arm with him was Sam Giancana.
Well, they were in business together in that casino.
I'm 16. How was I to know that? I thought when he was called before the commissions here in Vegas about his license for the Sands, he kept denying that he knew Sam. Anyway, he comes on to the set, and Francis can be very, very tough and very, very cruel. He was handed the material that he was going to do, and he would literally throw the pages down on the ground and say, "Who wrote this shit?" And the place was cleared out. Nobody was allowed to be in there. And I moved from the front row in an empty studio to the very back. And then George Slaughter handed him a piece. I knew he hated Rex Reed. And I heard him read out loud this line. Rex Reed finally saw something he liked, a sequin dress at Bloomingdale's. And he screamed, and his people screamed, and then there were a few other jokes like that. And he said, "Who wrote this?" And I was in the back row, and Digby said, "John." He's sitting way up there. And he says, "Kid." And I wasn't a kid. I was in my early 40s. He said, "Come down here." So I come down. He says, "You wrote all this?" And I said, "Yeah." He says, "This is the stuff I'm going to do." So after we taped the material, he called me aside and asked me if I would mind writing all of his special material, and especially his angry letters to the editors. One of them was to Meet People magazine, which you quoted in my way. So now this gets a lot more intriguing. So for 3 or 4 years, that's all I did. When he was roasted on... at the Friars Roast, before they had ladies, I was the guy who roasted him. He invited me there to roast Howard Cosell and a lot of other very famous people. And I must tell you, I was extremely successful at doing that. And when Hubert Humphreys got cancer and they were having a special dinner, I wrote all the material for him for those things, and he paid me in cash, because the first time he paid me a check for $1,000, and I wouldn't cash it. I wanted to frame it. I wasn't making much money, Kitty, but I wanted to frame it. It was Frank Sinatra, for crying out loud. I remember as a kid listening to him. Saturday night is the loneliest night of the week.
Oh, yes.
Standing on that white pedestal in Technicolor singing Old Man River. I mean, all of it. I could tell you amazing stories about Sinatra, even when he was going to do the execution of Private Slovak, but I won't get into that. This is a story. Anyway, one day we're talking, and I said to him, I said, "You know, Francis, Bing Crosby died at 77 on a golf course in Spain. His music won't last as long as yours, and you know the reason for that." And he said, "Don't say anything negative about the King kid, because that's who I wanted to be when I was a youngster in Hoboken. I said, no. I said, his movies are great. He was a great entertainer. I loved his singing. But the truth is, you were a social force. And there's an entire difference between being a social force and being an entertainer. Had it not been for you singing High Hopes, John Kennedy might not have gotten into the White House. And I said, you know what you should really do? I said, because people are going to write about you. Tell your own story. He said, what do you mean, kid? I said, you know, let me come down to your house on the weekends with a television camera. I will put you on camera. You narrate your life story. I will ask you all kinds of questions, even from the first time I saw you with Sam Giancana. And he sort of stared at me. He said, when did you see me with Sam? And I told him the story. And he just laughed. He said, kid, you got balls. So anyway, he said, write it up.
And that he would have appreciated.
I wrote it up, Kelly. I gave it to his secretary, Dorothy. His studios were by the Formosa Grill, the Formosa Studios. He could not have been more wonderful to me. And we had planned it was going to be 10 1 hours. He was going to be on I told him, I said, you're going to be the Italian Roots. Remember that that series on ABC?
Absolutely.
Okay, yeah. Well, I said, he loved it. He's going to be, but you're going to tell your own story. You will never hear my voice. And we're going to go through your entire life. So he asked me how much I wanted. I said, you know, I would love doing it for nothing. I would do it. He said, kid, you'll get 10%, okay? So we shook hands. I was going to get 10%, and we were going to start. Now, unfortunately or fortunately, I created the first reality show called Real People. Ended up on NBC, was a monster hit. In the third year, we'd been number one for 2 years. We're getting 25,000 pieces of mail a week. I could not get to the point where I could start taping Sinatra. And Sinatra called me at the studio and he said, you know, I'm going to be hosting the Tonight Show and I want you to be my first guest. Will you come and do a stand-up? And if you go to my site, Killy, you will that introduction, that voice you heard at the top, was Sinatra. So if you went to my site, John Barber's World, you'll see the actual monologue. And there's a great story about that, which I won't get into. I'll get into the conclusion of this. Darn it. I'm sorry, Kelly, this is taking so long. But why this never came about? The reason it never came about is because William Holden died in a drunken stupor in his condominium in Santa Monica. So you might say, well, John, what on earth does this have to do with anything? Well, this is how the fickle fate sometimes really stabs you. At the time, I was co-chair of the committee to save Dr. Thomas Noguchi's job as the coroner of Los Angeles County, along with his attorney. Now, it seemed for 4 or 5 years, the city of Los Angeles, the police department, and the infiltrated police department by the CIA had been trying for a long time to get rid of Noguchi. If you go to records at the City Hall about the autopsy of Robert Kennedy, you will see the autopsy report says the fatal shot came from 2.5 to 3 inches behind the left ear because of the extensive powder burns to the skin and the scalp. Noguchi did not say anything other than that, but it meant that Sirhan could not have fired the fatal shot from 6 feet in front, okay? He would not change the autopsy. They were moving to get rid of him. And I would go around and speak to thousands of people in support of Noguchi. And everybody in L.A. wanted Noguchi as the county coroner because he was apolitical. Then Bill Holden dies. The Los Angeles Times report that Bill Holden had a heart attack, passed out, and died in his condominium. Then the body is delivered to Thomas Noguchi, and Tom Noguchi performs the perfect, excellent autopsy and concludes that Bill Holden was drunk. And Bill Holden was a horrible drunk. I'd seen him in NBC a number of times where he could barely walk, for crying out loud, and reported that Holden died drunk, falling down against the edge of a coffee table, cut his head, and bled to death. Sinatra and the Hollywood community were absolutely outraged that this Japanese coroner would say that one of their icons had died an alcoholic in an alcoholic stupor. So here I was defending Noguchi, and here Sinatra headed up a committee to get rid of Noguchi, was very successful, and we never spoke again. And only did I ever communicate Jilly, his companion, who died tragically in a car crash in Palm Springs in a Jaguar, out of which he could not escape. Many people thought he was done in, but it was just an accident. It was only through Jilly that I ever had any conversations about Francis. That ends part of that story.
Did you try and get in touch with Sinatra?
Once he got involved with Barbara, it was very difficult to get a hold of Sinatra. Jilly tried, because Jilly kept saying, you know, if Francis, he says, you know, John, you don't know how interesting Francis is when he talks about himself. Now, you may have seen HBO ran a two-part series on Sinatra last week. Now, because of your
book. I saw that.
Okay, well, when you saw the parts where Sinatra, they had these clips of Sinatra talking about himself, he was really interesting and he was really engaging. But I must tell you, Kitty, they left out tons of stuff. And Jilly would tell me, you know, Francis loves you. And I'm telling you, if you get him seated, you guys are going to have the best show in the history of show business. But we never could get, not even Jilly could get past Barbara.
Wow.
So anyway, I didn't want to be telling you this story, for crying out loud. You're the writer, and you're
the... You know something you just said, though, John? You said that Noguchi's autopsy report on Robert Kennedy's killing said one thing, and yet publicly we were told that Sirhan Sirhan killed the senator. Are you saying that Noguchi's report was honest and he was pressured to change it?
Absolutely. There was no way. You know what? You want to know something, Kitty? It is easier to prove that Sirhan did not shoot Bobby than it is to prove that Oswald did not shoot John Kennedy. And Oswald did not shoot John Kennedy. And that was one of the things that I was looking for. You know, while I would look through your entire book, I loved it. It's Capturing Camelot. The pictures are great. Your words are wonderful. The Martin Luther King thing also was wonderful. And the reason it was so heartbreakingly beautiful for me to look at is I miss the promise that was John Kennedy. I miss the promise that was Martin Luther King. I remember hearing Martin Luther King at the Riverside Church in New York a year before they blew his head off. And he said, I hate to say that the largest terrorist organization in the world is my own government and the United States military. And a year later, they blew his head off. I mean, Lyndon Johnson called off.
He was very much against the war in Vietnam, Martin Luther King was, and he really felt that the war would distract from the civil rights movement and the people that he was representing.
That's absolutely true. Anyway, Kitty, and I could tell you another story. You know, Sinatra was going to do The Execution of Private Slovak. Do you remember that book?
I do remember it, and he was going to try and break the blacklist.
Yes, that's right. But it was,
and it was Albert Maltz who wrote that.
Well,
and I interviewed him for the biography on Frank Sinatra.
No, it was William Bradford Huey who wrote The Execution of Private Slovak. William Bradford Huey, a very good crime writer from the South. I had written a script on speculation. Somebody had asked me if you were doing a movie, what would you do? Now, this is back in late 50s. Oh, my God. And I said, I would do a Western one day that takes place one day. So the set is outdoors. It's morning till night. So on speculation, I wrote this script, and a fellow named Haskell Wexler read it. Haskell Wexler was one of the great cinematographers in the world. He's done great movies. The Liz Taylor, Richard Burton movie where they're yelling, Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf? Did a lot. Anyway, he optioned Albert Maltz's A Hard Day, A Long Day, and A Short Life. And he asked me if I would adapt it. I knew nothing about The Blacklist. I'm this kid from Canada, for crying out loud, who just got off of a freight train. And I'm up at his mansion, and I'm living out of my car. So in 6 weeks, I write this. Then he has Richard Widmark and Carl Malden and some others come to his house to read my script. And they're all thrilled about the fact. And the reason that Haskell bought it is because Sinatra was at Columbia doing the execution of Private Slovak. And he was hired Maltz to do the screenplay. And so Haskell felt that Albert's books would become hot. He optioned Albert's book, A Long Day and A Short Life. So we were getting all ready to do this movie when Joe Kennedy got to Sinatra and talked him out of doing it. So he shelved it. And when he shelved it, Haskell shelved A Long Day and A Short Life, putting me back in my car and out on the streets. And I said, hey, this has nothing to do with the execution of Private Slovak, for crying out loud. It's still a pretty good script. And he backed away from it. So anyway, I got tons of those stories. I mean, tons of them. But I want to talk about Kitty Kelly. I don't want to be talking about me. Anyway, again, back to the Robert Kennedy thing. The best book on that assassination is He Who Must Die. It's written by an ex-priest named Robert Blair Kaiser. And he got to talk to Sirhan, got to talk to the psychiatrist, talked to his defense team, wrote this great book. He left the book and his papers with me and fled the country because he was afraid for his life. And I think Robert is still alive to this day. But it's just astounding. Anyway, to Kitty Kelly, you dedicated Capturing Camelot to your husband. Tell me about your husband. Kitty? Oh, God, don't tell me. Kitty? Oh, Jesus.
Thank you for that smile upon your face, oh sunny.
Hi, this is John Barber. You may remember me as the co-host, producer, and creator of Real People, America's first reality show, or most recently as the writer-director of what's been called the definitive documentary on JFK's murder, The Last Word on the Assassination. Now I'm doing a show every other Monday from 5 to 6 Pacific time on BBS. You'll hear provocative views, unreported news, and film reviews from me, with outstanding guests and you. Join me on John Barber's World.
You're listening to BBS Radio. If it's not mainstream, it's on bbsradio.com.
Those of you who have an ongoing interest in the JFK assassination might want to know about this. TV producer John Barber. He put together a dream team of JFK researchers, including Coast regular Jim Mars and world-class JFK writers Dick Russell and Joan Mellon. They all got together at UNLV in front of a live audience. They had a screening of Barber's terrific, and I'd say historic, film based on interviews with prosecutor Jim Garrison of New Orleans. And then after the film was shown, the experts all talked about the latest JFK theories and evidence. It's now out on a DVD. Terrific stuff. I'm George Knapp, Coast to Coast AM.
Hi, I'm Richard Belzer. This is the great BBS Radio.
Now the dark days are done, and the bright days are here. My sunny one shines so sincere. Sunny one so true, I love you.
Our next guest is one of those rare talents who has something to say and can say it funny. He's a writer-performer on the new Laugh-In and one of the most popular, outspoken, and entertaining personalities on the local news here in Los Angeles. He's won a half a dozen Emmys as a film critic and host of his own shows. Let's welcome Mr. John Barber, right over there.
Hi, this is John Barber again. I'm sorry we got cut off. We were in the middle of talking to this just amazing, amazing writer, Kitty Kelly, and talking about her books, Capturing Camelot and Let Freedom Ring. And Kitty, what happened that we got cut off?
You were telling this wonderful story about Frank Sinatra trying to break the blacklist with the execution of Private Slovak. And just as you were telling me that you had submitted a script, we got hit by lightning. I'm on the East Coast, and we're under a tornado watch.
Oh, my gosh. Oh,
and
my
it's God. Almost enough to make you believe that the spirit of Frank Sinatra did it his way.
Well, it could be. Maybe he's encouraging me to tell the story and not striking me down again.
Well, but good. Tell the story, John.
Okay. Well, I'll finish it as quickly as I can. Anyway, I wrote the adaptation in about 6 weeks, and Haskell gathered these very famous actors, Richard Widmark and a few others, reading this, all excited, right? And the reason that Haskell had bought the script is because Sinatra, trying to break the blacklist by hiring Albert Maltz, Haskell thought all of his books would become popular again. So he optioned A Long Day and a Short Life. Anyway, Joe Kennedy got to Sinatra because his son was running for the presidency and didn't think it would be a very good idea to be hiring a blacklisted, un-American writer to do this particular story. So Sinatra, as a favor to the Kennedys, backed down. Well, when he backed down, Haskell Wexler decided that he wasn't going to do A Long Day and a Short Life. And I said to him, but Haskell, it has nothing to do with Albert Maltz. His name isn't even on it. I mean, it doesn't even say adapted from an Albert Maltz book. It just says written by John Barber from the book, A Long Day and a Short Life. And we parted company after that. I did one other script for him. So that never happened. But I could tell you tons of stories about that. And in closing, and getting back to the business of the Robert Kennedy assassination, the very best book on that subject is written by a former priest named Robert Blair Kaiser. Jeez, Kitty, how can I remember these names and things after all these years? Anyway, it was called He Who Must Die. He got to speak to Sirhan, his psychiatrist, the ones who hypnotized them. He left his book with me and his papers with me and left the country he so feared for his life. But I think that Robert is still alive and somewhere could be approached. But anyway, what I wanted to really talk to you about was you, Kitty, because you're such an interesting woman and such a thorough writer. You dedicated Capturing Camelot to your husband. Tell me about your husband.
Well, my husband died a few years ago, and that book you're talking about, Capturing Camelot, came out just a few months after he had died. He died very suddenly in La Quinta, California, where we were for the winter. The book came about because I inherited the photo archive of Stanley Tredick, who was one of President Kennedy's favorite photographers. Stanley took that famous photograph of John playing under the Oval Office desk in the President's office. Well, I took care of Stanley in the last few years of his life, and he didn't have any really much. He didn't have many resources, and he left me his photo archive, and I just couldn't. I couldn't give it away. We were very, very good friends, and I used to stop by his house, and he had this Marine Corps trunk that he used as a coffee table in his den. And I said, "Stanley, what do you have in there?" Because it was locked, and you couldn't unlock it. And he said, "Oh, nude photos." I said, "Oh." And I just dropped the subject and went on to something else. After Stanley died, they delivered the trunk, and my husband, John Zucker, answered the door, and he said, "What is this?" And I said, "Oh, that's Stanley's Marine Corps locker." And he said, "Well, what's in it?" I said, "Nude photos." He said, "What?" I said, "Nude photos." He said, "Well, open it." I said, "I don't want to open it, and I don't want to remember Stanley that way." He said, "Well, I do." So he took the trunk out in the kitchen, and I went upstairs. About an hour and a half later, John came upstairs, and I said, "Well, did you have a good time?" And he said, "Honey, they aren't nude photos." He said, "There are diaries, diary entries from the Kennedys when Stanley covered the president, how he got the photographs he got, letters from JFK, letters from Jackie." He said, "A diary of Stanley's journal when he went to England with Jackie to cover her and the dedication at Runnymede." I said, "Really?" I couldn't believe it. And I went downstairs, and it was just a trove of all of this Kennedy information and fabulous photographs. And I just couldn't give it away, and I let it sit for a while. And then I finally put together this book, Capturing Camelot, because many of the photographs really hadn't been seen before. And when I was putting it together, I went through all of the archives that Stanley left me, and I found 100 pictures from the March on Washington.
Wow. And
Martin Luther King that had never been published. So I asked the publisher if they would publish Let Freedom Ring.
Well, I must tell you, they're just, and the reason they, is, I repeat, they're sort of heartbreaking to me is because I look at them and I miss the promise that was John Kennedy. You know, I remember Von Meter's The First Family, the largest selling comedy album ever, and I thought, "Oh my God, how wonderful to have a man like that in the White House who can appreciate that kind of satire and who's witty and intelligent on his own." The fact that the Vietnam War would have probably been ended, the Federal Reserve might have been ended. I mean, it's heartbreaking to think about that. That may have been on November 22nd, 1963, may have been America's funeral. And as I looked at the book, aside from thinking about you and appreciating the words, I thought of Dorothy Kilgallen. Do you remember her?
Oh, Sinatra hated her. She was a columnist that wrote in New York. He hated her.
Yes.
He called her the chinless wonder.
Yes.
You know, he really just had such animus towards a lot of women writers.
Well, not only did he hate her, my very favorite talk show host ever was Jack Parr, and he hated her. But he was really funny about her. But the thing that she did, which reminded me of you or made me think about it, because I was looking for touches of this maybe in the book or in the pictures or in the context, was the fact that somehow or another this lady, like you probably could do, finagled an interview with Jack Ruby. And she gave a copy of her material to her assistant. And 2 days later, she said she was going to break this story wide open, and she was found dead. They called it a suicide. When I doubt very much it was a suicide, they never found her papers on the interview with Ruby. And then her assistant was found dead. And they never found her papers either. So I just, you know, it just sent chills through me. And then also the Martin Luther King thing. Tell you, and you probably know this story about Martin Luther King, his dream speech. You know, he never wrote the dream speech.
No, he had given it. He'd given variations of it a couple of times before he delivered it on the Mall.
Yeah,
when they had the March on Washington in August of 1963.
Yeah, the type version is in the possession of a very successful basketball player, and it has nothing about the dream. I had a dream in it. He was offered over $1 million by someone who wished to collect it, and he wouldn't sell it. Good for him, he wouldn't sell it. But the way the speech came about, Mahalia Jackson was a close friend of mine, mostly my wife's. My wife used to sing for a great jazz pianist, a guy named Earl Father Hines, who had a band, a big band in San Francisco, knew Mahalia quite well. And Mahalia predicted she would have a son, which she had, a wonderful, wonderful child. And if there's such a thing as reincarnation, I want to come back as my son because he had the best parents in the world. But anyway, she was... She was standing next to Martin Luther King in Washington, and there was huge applause almost every time he spoke. And then when there was a long pause, she leaned into him and she said, "Martin, why don't you tell these folks about the dream you tell me about?" And he ad-libbed it.
He did. He really did. And the speech lasted for 17 minutes.
Yeah. And,
it was the most famous speech he ever gave.
It's one of the most famous. Next to Gettysburg, it's probably the most famous speech in American history. Anyway, your husband, you married late. Was John your first husband?
No, he was the best one.
Did you have
The first one, not so good.
Okay.
But John, fabulous.
Okay, did you have as many husbands as you did bestsellers?
No. No, okay. I had more bestsellers than husbands.
Oh, okay. Now, okay. Were you sort of a rabble-rousing, troublemaking kid?
No.
Where were you born? What was your family background like?
My family background was, I went to Catholic girls' school, and I was very obedient, although I come from a large family. And if you ask my sisters or my brother, did Kitty always want to be a writer? They would say, no, she wanted to be an only child.
Oh, that's wonderful. That's
and it's true. It is, and that is true. But I really wasn't a rabble-rouser, but I put a big premium on trying to get answers to questions. And when you're raised Catholic and on the Baltimore Catechism, which I was, John, there were rote answers for things. Who made you? God made me. Why did he make you? He made me to know, love, and serve him in this life and be happy with him in the next. There was no, well, did he really make me? You know, you really couldn't question things. And so as I got older, I kept questioning and questioning. And my father told me that, he said, "Kitty, you know, I knew there was going to be a problem with you eventually." I said, "Daddy, how can you say that? I was never a rebel. I didn't do this. I didn't do that." And he said, "Well, you were in the second grade, and the sister asked you if you wanted a vocation. And all the other little girls raised their hands and said they wanted to become sisters. They wanted to become brides of Christ." And he said, "She asked you what you wanted to be, and did you want to be a nun? And you said no." I said, "Well, what did I say?" And he said, "The sister said, well, don't you have a vocation? Don't you want to be a religious? What would you want to be?" And I said, "I think I'd want to be the bishop."
Oh,
well, that was unheard of for a little girl to say.
Oh, that's wonderful. You know, my father had left us to go to the peace and quiet of World War II when I was only 5 or 6 years of age. And I must have read the Bible about 100 times looking for purpose. And then a friend that I played with, his mother and father went to church every Sunday. So I thought I'd go with them. I lasted about 6 months. I prayed all the time. It was Somerset Maugham. Did you ever read his autobiography, The Summing Up?
No, I didn't.
Oh, God.
Should I?
Oh, it's a very short book, but it's a wonderful book for a writer. Anyway, he was about 12 or 13 and is being raised by this really mean, nasty bishop or preacher of some sort. And Somerset Maugham had this terrible, terrible stammer. And he knew that God appreciated it. The more you suffered, the more you'd be rewarded. So he said one cold night, he took off all his clothes and got down on the concrete floor on his hands and knees and prayed hard to God that he would wake up in the morning, he could speak like his uncle and like everybody else. So he said he went to bed happy that he would be waking up in the morning and speaking. So he got up and he rushed into the bathroom and looked into the mirror and started to talk. And continued to stutter. He said that's when he gave up on God. Well, I gave up on God when I was praying every night that my father would come home. In the middle of one of my friend's minister's speeches, I just couldn't take it anymore. I was 12 years of age, and I walked out of the church, and I sat down on the steps. And when it was all over, the minister saw me there, as did this family who gathered around me, and I looked kind of forlorn. And the minister came over, put his arm around my shoulders, and he said, "John, are you familiar with God's will?" And I don't know where it came from, Kitty, but I looked up and I said, "I don't know. I haven't read it yet." So,
anyway. Am I in it?
evidently I wasn't. Anyway, how did you get from Washington State to Washington, D.C.? And then I believe you ended up working with Senator Eugene McCarthy. And how did that come about? And how did that transform you?
Well, it really had quite an impact on me. Because I had taken a temporary job just because I wanted to work on the Hill at that time. And I didn't come from a Democratic family at all. As a matter of fact, my parents were rather staunch Republicans. And I got this job with Senator McCarthy, and it was only going to be for about 6 weeks. But it ended up being for about 4 years. And it really had an impact on me now that I'm old and I can look back, because I saw he took a phone call standing at my desk in the fall of 1967, and he was trying to convince Senator Kennedy, Robert Kennedy, to stand up and run for office and to oppose Lyndon Johnson's war in Vietnam. And he said, "Bobby, you can do it. You can do it. You can lead this. It's important." Anyway, Senator Kennedy wouldn't do it, and McCarthy did. And it was quite something to see a man stand up for something he really believed in and oppose the president of the United States, the president of his own party, and then pay the price for it. It really left quite an impression on me.
I remember it all well, and I remember feeling a little upset at the fact that Eugene was becoming quite successful in his anti-war campaign, and the more successful he became, the more it seemed to lure Bobby Kennedy in, and Bobby Kennedy was knocking off the man who probably might have been a better president than even Bobby.
Well, you know something? After June 6, 1968, when Kennedy was assassinated, I think that really took the life out of Senator McCarthy. He went through the ritual because he didn't want to let people down. And then when we all went to Chicago for the convention, it was such a bloody mess. So many people were beaten up and hurt and mauled, that McCarthy, who had been close to Hubert Humphrey, they both were from the state of Minnesota, could not get Humphrey to make the call to Mayor Daley to call the police off all the people in Grant Park. And I think that's one reason why Gene McCarthy held back his endorsement of Humphrey as late as he did. And a lot of people really feel strongly that it was Eugene McCarthy's fault that brought us Richard Nixon.
It wasn't Eugene McCarthy's fault that brought us Richard Nixon. It was the system. You know, I started off the show talking about the fact that I had given up watching Larry King, except when that fake war started in Iraq. I couldn't wait to hear what Kitty Kelly would have to say if she got on Larry King's show about the Bushes. What would you have said at that time had you gotten to be on his show about what was happening to Iraq, and what did the Bushes have to do with it?
Well, King wouldn't let me on the show because he was told, because he, as he admits, does not read the books, but was told that it was critical of the Bushes. Actually, it was a tough book to write because it's a three-generational saga of this progressive Republican Prescott Bush, who was a United States senator. He was anti-Semitic, but he was progressive in other areas. And then his son, George Herbert Walker Bush, and then his son, George W. Bush. And I tried to bring all three generations together.
Did any of the family talk to you?
Yes, they did. And when that book came out, it was really pretty tough because the President of the United States denounced it. The Bush family denounced it. The chairman of the Republican National Committee denounced it. Tom DeLay, who was the leader in the House of Representatives, denounced it. It was a very, very tough book. And so much so that a Bush appointee who owned the Washingtonian magazine at the time insisted that I be taken off the masthead. I had been a contributing editor for 33 years.
Oh, my.
So, and I'm not saying this like, well, it was a huge price to pay. It wasn't like being embedded in the Middle East or covering
yes.
Syria or anything, but it was quite a blowback from the Bushes.
When you do your research into your books, the one I'm especially interested in is Sinatra. It would seem to me that Francis probably wouldn't talk to you.
Oh, John, not only would he not talk, he sued me before I wrote a word.
I remember that.
Yeah, he sued to stop this book. He kept the lawsuit going for 1 year before he would drop it. He had sent a message to the publisher. He sent a message to everybody. He didn't want this book written. And so, but I kept on going.
Was that your first major bio?
No, the first one was the biography of Jacqueline Kennedy Onassis called Jackie O. And then after that, I wrote a biography of Elizabeth Taylor, and then came the Sinatra book. And it was a huge book for me because there was a huge commitment from the publisher. And I really started out quite excited about doing the book because even to this day, my feelings for Frank Sinatra are as complicated as the man himself. I adore his music. I still adore his music. I think that he was the best interpreter of the American songbook ever in the 20th century.
You know how you can tell that, Kitty? And I knew nearly all of them. I was opening act for many great singers. And one of the people I admired most was Dean Martin, and then I love John Gary, lyric, baritone, just beautiful. You can get one of their CDs, but you can only listen to two or three songs. You never, ever get tired of listening to Sinatra sing.
No, I agree with you. I agree with you. Especially ballads.
Oh, my goodness, yes. Yes, it's astonishing. I mean, you'll hear him for hundreds of years in actuality. But you're absolutely right. He was a very, very complicated individual. And my wife and I will always love him because he was just so terrific to me. But I've seen him be really cruel to some other people.
Yes, and that's that dichotomy of this man who just sings so beautifully, and he really nourished his talent. He was given a fabulous talent, and the times that he was happiest, I think, was when he was on stage. And I think it just killed him as he grew old, and he lost his hearing, his sight wasn't good, he had strokes, he had two heart attacks, he had cancer, he had a colostomy. And he finally had to stop performing, and I think that just within 2 or 3 years, he then died.
Yes, he did. And the lawsuit lasted how long? About a year?
It lasted too long. it lasted a year, and then he finally dropped it.
And then were you ever fearful at any time about really strong repercussions to you about some of the material that you were writing?
Well, there were people who said that I should be very, very careful, even FBI agents that I interviewed. Mm. Tony Danza told me many years later that he was surprised that I was still alive, and he said, I'm not saying this jokingly. He said, they hate you. Paul Anka just wrote a book about a year or so ago, and he said that there was a hit out on Kitty Kelly.
I read that, but you know what? I must tell you, I do not think Francis would initiate something like that, but
he
some
did
of
say,
his
John,
friends...
I want that woman to stay in good health, because if anything happens to her, I'll be the first one blamed.
Well, a
so
lot
that
of...
made me feel good. Sure.
Well, because a lot of his friends, as a favor to him, might have offed you and then let it be known that they had done it as a favor. And frankly, he would have been upset. I mean, there were a lot of people that he hated and didn't want to see around. But there was a guy at the Sands Hotel. You might remember this story. This fella, Cohen.
Carl Cohen.
Yeah, the night manager at the Sands Casino, when Sinatra was making an ass of himself at the blackjack tables, and Cohen knocked his teeth out. But Sinatra never wanted anything done to Cohen. He just said, leave him alone. Frank went to a dentist. Is there something that you have learned about either Oprah or Jackie or any of the people about whom you've written about really magnificently? Is there anything you've learned about them that either really surprised you or you didn't put in your book?
To answer the first question, yes. When you devote 3-4 years to researching somebody's life, especially somebody in the public eye, and I only write about people who are really powerful and have had an effect on our lives, on society in some way, either politically or culturally. Frank Sinatra had both. Elizabeth Taylor was a star of a studio system that no longer exists. Jacqueline Kennedy Onassis was terribly powerful in the way that she influenced America and in the sadness that befell her with her husband's assassination. Nancy Reagan was very powerful first lady, and that fascinated me to try and understand how she really influenced Ronald Reagan. I then wrote a book on the Bush family called The Family. I wrote about the British monarchy, the House of Windsor, and 2 weeks before publication, Princess Diana was killed. So that was a sadness in the publication of that book. And the last large-scale biography I did was on Oprah Winfrey.
And did Oprah talk to you at all?
No. John, I do something called an unauthorized biography, which unauthorized does not mean untrue, but I interview. I don't do it with someone's permission. Because if you do an authorized biography, you have to give that person editorial control. And there will be things that they don't want published because the people that I have written about are so hugely powerful that their public image is dependent upon manufacturing from publicists and public relations specialists. So to submit my manuscript for editorial control would be very tough. But I do go through batteries of lawyers, justify everything I've written, turn in tape recordings, correspondence, all files. So sometimes I feel like it takes as long to legally vet a book as it does to write it.
Well, the one that I'm waiting for you to write, and I hope you're working on it now, is one about Bill Clinton.
Don't you think we've had a lot? Well, I shouldn't say that because there were a lot of books written on Frank Sinatra. And
yes, there were a lot of books about the Bush. Your book about the Bushes, there are two great books about the Bushes, and yours is one of them. And yet they still seem to sell. But Bill Clinton, I just got to tell you off the top of my head, Ronald Reagan was an immensely charming man, but I interviewed him for an hour on my morning show in Los Angeles when he was running for my second term as governor, and trying to capture that man was like trying to shovel smoke. And I must tell you, he didn't exist. And when we went afterwards to look at the tape, because I was sure he came across badly, when we went into the viewing room and looked at the tape, Kitty, he was like Cary Grant. I mean, he just leapt off the screen.
Yes.
The camera literally loved the man. I mean, absolutely and totally loved the man. But anyway, and Clinton is a lot more intelligent. He was a Rhodes Scholar, which to me, sadly, I don't mean to editorialize, but makes him more evil because he was so much smarter. With the signing
more
of death,
evil? Did you say evil?
Yes, and I apologize if you're a fan, because when Ross Perot, who was sort of Jimmy Stewart, the third candidate trying to get running for president, when he had to pay for his own time when he was campaigning, and he would point at George Bush on one side and he would point at Clinton on the other side, he would say, if either one of these men become president and sign NAFTA, it will destroy American manufacturing and American jobs. How prescient was that? And he had to back out of the campaign because they threatened to kill his daughter, who was about to be married. Now, Clinton not only signs NAFTA, he deregulates the Federal Communications Commission to the point that six major corporations own 95% of all American media. He repealed Glass-Steagall, which allowed Wall Street and the banks to steal America and my house. Nobody went to prison or was even arrested for those multiple crimes. And then there was no need for Waco. He killed. We're not. Kitty, are you there?
I am. My mouth is wide open. Excuse
yeah.
me. John, you're the one who should write the book, not me. You write it.
Well, I don't do. I'm in my fifth year of trying to do my own autobiography right now, and it's called Your Mother's Not a Virgin, and I'm about I'm about two-thirds of the way through it. Anyway, Kitty, oh, God, I absolutely adore you. I adore your work. I'm sorry lightning struck, but with you, Kitty, when you were born, lightning struck in Washington.
Aren't you?
And you turned into just such a fabulous, fabulous writer. And I do hope I get to meet you someday, and I hope that you and I get a chance to talk on this little radio show again once more.
I'd love it, John.
Oh, again, thank you so much, Kitty. And where can folks get the book?
Amazon, bookstores, any place.
Okay, terrific. And the books are called what?
Capturing Camelot and Let Freedom Ring. And then for the biographies, of course, His Way, Frank Sinatra, Nancy Reagan, Oprah Winfrey, The House of Windsor, Jackie O, and the Bush family. It's called The Family.
And the Royals. Kitty, again,
and the
thank
Royals.
You.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, and I look forward to talking to you again. Have a wonderful night.
Thank you, John.
Bye, dear.
You're my spark of nature's fire. You're my sweet, complete desire. A sunny, 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 I love you.